close encounters of the second kind have drawn greater scientific interest simply because investigators have more to work with than just the testimony of witnesses. Again, Dr. Hynek.
Close encounters of the second kind were those in which there were some definite physical traces. In fact, we called them physical trace cases. The UFO, in those cases, interacted with the environment, either animate or inanimate, affecting animals, affecting machines and electrical circuits and so forth, and also affecting the ground. For instance, leaving burnt marks on the ground, holes in the ground, broken tree branches. In other words, physical effects that were directly associated with the reported craft.
Ted Phillips is a veteran UFO investigator who specializes in sightings where some physical trace of the incident is left. Close encounters of the second kind.
I think the physical trace landing cases give us the most direct approach to resolving the UFO problem, without question. Because we've compiled aerial observation, visual observations for 30 years. And they really, they don't tell us that much. I mean, they tell us what the UFO looks like, how it acts at various speeds, colors, and so on. But what we need is something we can take into a laboratory.
One of Phillips' most interesting cases occurred on June 28, 1973, outside Columbia, Missouri. Just after midnight, James Richards, an employee of the University of Missouri, and his 16-year-old daughter, Anne, were preparing for bed in their trailer home on an isolated country road. Richards' 3-year-old son, Jamie, woke up and began to cry. The events that followed so frightened the Richards that Anne still refuses to discuss them. But James Richards remembers.
My daughter was going to the icebox refrigerator to get some milk for the baby. And she notices two bright lights, like spotlights, and then they converge into one big round ball, illuminate the whole area with the trees swaying and it almost blinded me because I couldn't look directly because it's too bright, like an eclipse. That's what I took it to see. So I looked at it on an angle, you might say, you see. And then, two, the trees were swaying. And then we heard outside this thrashing going around the tree. And so I got kind of shook, naturally. So I went and got my guns. I loaded them, and my daughter went and ran, locked the door. Something did snap in my mind, though, not to shoot. Because it's a rule, anytime I heard anything outside at night, the first thing I would do is get my flashlight and a gun. I don't care what it is. I'll go outside and start searching. But something clicked in my mind and said, don't go outside. Don't go outside. And I just left the guns there on top of the deep freeze and just looked out the window and just observed the best I could. You have to see it yourself to really have an idea of what I'm talking about. Because nothing that I know of turns its colors, all different colors, beautiful colors, and do a 90-degree angle without making a sound, and hover there in space. Boy. And you sit there and look in awe, you know. Boy, I said, my, it's pretty. But yet and still, you was frightened because you were dealing with something that you never seen before. You had no idea, you see. You didn't know what it was going to do any harm or what.
Members of the Richards family weren't the only ones affected by the presence of the strange craft.
I have a doghouse out there on that side. And them dogs scurry up under the building and stay till the whole event was over. They didn't bark at all. No siree.
With a feeling of relief, Richards watched as the light dimmed somewhat and began to ease away. But suddenly, it made a sharp turn and approached the trailer again.
When it came back up the second time, I felt like death was at hand. I figured this was it. And as soon as it touched down, then the whole area just lit up. See, you was actually blind, you see, but you could hear the thrash and the walk around this particular tree, just this one tree now. Then my daughter said, look at the tree, just pulling on a tree. And then the next thing, you heard the tree snap, that limb snap. And I tried to call for help. This time my lights went completely out and came back on, but you couldn't call out. Telephone line was dead. You didn't hear a buzz tone or anything. Couldn't nobody call in. I couldn't call out. Just complete, like your wires were cut until they left.
In the course of his investigation of the Richards case, Ted Phillips spoke with a telephone operator who had traced the aborted emergency call.
I talked to the operator, contacted by the directory assistance operator, and she had been trying for 3 minutes to call Richards, but the line was indeed dead. Finally, suddenly, after she had tried 5 times, she broke through and he was on the line. Well, when the police arrived, it was a young officer by himself. Richards told him what had happened, and he said the officer didn't seem to be too excited about going out into this darkened area. So they took a flashlight, they went over the fence, and sure enough, they found some imprints, which are about 5 inches long, about 3 inches wide, and about 2 to 2.5 inches into the ground. Now, I have to point out that the next day, a newspaper reporter was out there. He picked it up from the police blotter. And this reporter weighs about 350 pounds, and he could barely make a heel mark in the ground. It was that dry, that hard. So we're talking about considerable weight. At the site, then, I found this series, this pattern of imprints down through there. The tree limb, which was twisted and pulled down, stripped down at a point 12 and a half feet above the ground. And several other broken limbs. We arrived there a week after the event, and leaves were absolutely burnt, very badly burnt, down in the lower regions where the UFO had been. And leaves on the limbs some 40, 45 feet up in the air above this area were starting to die.
That big tree is completely dead today. The Richards have since moved to a new home surrounded by plenty of neighbors. But their hope of finding an answer for what they saw that night in June remains empty. The most intriguing types of UFO experiences, called close encounters of a third kind by Dr. Hynek, are those involving contact with humanoid occupants.
Close encounters of the third kind are those in which creatures, entities, beings, humanoids, ufonauts, call them what you will, were reported in direct association with the sighted craft.
Just after sunset, on the evening of November 5, 1975, a 7-man crew was piling into a 4-wheel drive vehicle after finishing a day of wood cutting near the tiny northern Arizona community of Snowflake. One of the 7 men was Travis Walton, whose curiosity that night plunged him into a living nightmare he would never forget. Just before leaving the work area, the men in the Jeep watched a glowing object emerge from behind the trees. Travis opened a door to get a better view and continued watching, stunned with his companions.
The thing was about 90 feet away, about 20 feet in diameter, about 8 feet high. It was glowing a golden color, kind of like molten metal. I couldn't hear anything at first. It must have been because when I got closer, I could hear it. But it was a high-pitched, intermittent sound. And a low rumbling sound. It sounded like machinery or, you know, a heavy mechanical sound. Very difficult to describe.
Travis got out of the vehicle and moved toward the object, despite cries from his friends for him to return. Walton assumed by the time he could get any closer, the object would be gone.
Just as I got up close, it started to move with a sort of a rocking motion, kind of like a spinning top, you know, like when it's slowing down to fall over, except it wasn't spinning it. The same side stayed toward me. And when it started to move, it got real loud, and that really scared me, and I jumped down behind a log, and I looked up at this thing, and I decided then I was in a lot of danger, and I was going to get the heck out of there. And I raised up to go. It's the last thing I remember. I raised up, and I started to turn. And I was just about in a high crouch when, wham, I felt a numbing shock hit me. It kind of like in the head, and I went out. I was knocked unconscious.
His 6 co-workers, however, saw what Travis had not. A slender beam of intense light which shot from the craft and lifted Walton off his feet, knocking him to the ground. The rest of the crew sped away in panic, looking back to see the craft take off. But when they returned to see if Travis was all right, he was nowhere to be found. When Travis finally came to, he was weak, groggy, and in pain. Above him was a light. He assumed he was in a hospital bed, But as his blurred vision became clearer, he discovered he was wrong.
I felt something pressing on my chest. My shirt and my jacket pushed up, and there was this thing laying across it. It was about 4 or 5 inches thick. The thing extended down over my rib cage and down to my belt. And when I looked up and I saw this thing, it was gray. And I looked past the edge of it and I saw something white. My eyes weren't focusing real good. And at first I thought it was a doctor, you know, white mask and cap. But when I got to where I could see, I saw this thing and I just came unglued. I looked around me and there was three of them. I just panicked. I became hysterical.
As his eyes became accustomed to the surroundings, Travis saw his captors in more detail.
They were about 4 feet 10. Had very large heads. No hair on their heads. No eyebrows. No whiskers or anything like that. They had very large eyes. Those eyes are something that really bothered me worse than anything. The rest of their features were small. It was like small ears, small nose, small mouth, hardly any lips if they had any lips. I never saw them open their mouth. But they were wearing a long coverall type things. They were orangish tan. When I saw them, I struck out. I pushed this one on my right and he fell back into another one. They felt kind of marshmallowy, kind of like fat, you know. Whereas, you know, when you push against somebody with muscle, it feels differently. But they seemed light unexpectedly. And I jumped off the table there and staggered over into the corner. There was a bench across the wall and I leaned there. And I was really weak and I was so scared, you know, I was shaking and they started towards me. And I started just screaming at them, you know, telling them to keep away from me. And I reached over and I grabbed a thing off of the table. There was some bunch of things there and there was a clear tube about maybe an inch in diameter, I don't know, a foot and a half long. And I thought, it wasn't heavy like glass, and it was too light for a club, and so I wanted to defend myself, and so I hit it against the table to break it, you know, maybe get a sharp point, but it didn't break. But I lashed out at them with it, and I kept screaming. They only took a couple of steps, and they stopped.
After the creatures departed, Travis left the room through the same door, but went down the hallway in the opposite direction.
I came to a doorway on my right, and I went into this. Oh, I didn't go right in. I looked in, and it was a round room, a domed room, with a chair in the middle. And it was really funny about this room. It's really strange. It looked like, you know, I could see the walls and everything, the same as there were everything else in that place. It was all just this matte gray metal look. But when I went towards the chair, I didn't go towards the chair right away. I walked around towards the side because the chair was high-backed and I was afraid that there might be one of those things sitting in that chair. So I went around there and when I could see that there was nobody in the chair, I walked over to it. But the closer I got to the chair, the darker the room seemed. And I could start seeing points of light like the stars. There was buttons there. You know, I did a stupid thing. I pushed some. Hoping to open a door or something. But when that didn't work, well, I got scared of doing that too because it made the stars move. I turned and there was a man standing in the doorway I came through. And this guy, I mean, he appeared human to me, you know, which was a big relief. And I ran up there and started asking him all kinds of questions and just smiled. Kind of tolerant-like, and I assumed that maybe he couldn't hear me because he had the helmet on his head, and a clear helmet. And so when he motioned for me, and he took me by the arm, I went with him. I assumed I was being rescued.
Travis was led out of the craft and into a large hangar, where more human-like figures were present. He remembers their appearance this way.
They'd pass, you know, on the street, but they had a strange thing to their eyes. They were a light color, a golden hazel, you know, and they had a resemblance to each other, like a family, but not identical. There was one of them that was a woman, I could tell, had longer hair, a female shape. One of the men and the woman came over there and they put me on the table and they put a mask over my face and I started to resist and they held me on the table and they put this mask on my face and I reached up to pull it away and before I could, everything went black.
Meanwhile, the other members of the woodcutting crew had reported Walton missing. Local police organized a search party, but no trace of Walton was found. The next thing he remembered, Travis was lying on the side of a road outside Heber, Arizona, 12 miles from Snowflake.
When I first regained consciousness, I was laying on the roadway, well, to the side of the road, more off than on, and my head was on my arm, and I saw a light, and I looked up in time to see it go off, which I think was either a light going off or a hatch closing, perhaps. Then I saw that this object hovering there. It was a flattened sphere. I mean, it was shaped like a disc, but it was very shiny, chrome-like. I could see that reflecting everything around there, but not giving off any light. It was dark. And it was just there for a second, hovering about 4 feet off the ground. And then it just shot straight up. It was incredible how quick, without making a sound.
Travis staggered to a phone booth to call his family, who at first did not believe it was really him. But once convinced, they came to take him home. On the way, Travis received yet another shock.
We were riding back in, and Mary said something about everybody being worried about me. I can't remember the exact conversation, but I said, well, you know, it must have been a bad couple of hours or something to reference the time or something like that. And they said, Travis, you've been gone for 5 days.
While recuperating, Travis was able to remember most of what had happened to him. A series of hypnotic regressions with Dr. James Harder from the University of California, however, enabled Walton to recall things with less anxiety and more detail. What you are about to hear is a rare edited portion of one of those hypnotic sessions, in which Travis Walton offers a chilling recollection of his face-to-face encounter with his abductors.
You can describe what he looks like to us and it won't bother you. It's just like you were trying to describe something for someone who was going to draw something.
He's ugly.
You can describe what he looks like to us and it won't bother you.
He looks so white. He looks soft. Rubbery. He looks Chinese.
Do you get a picture of what the eyes look like?
I look at his eyes. They're big, round eyes. They move.
Can you see what color they might be?
Brown.
Brownish. Take a good look at the pupil. Can you tell me what the pupil looks like?
Only horses have eyes like that.
Because of its sensational nature, UFO debunkers have singled out the Travis Walton case for criticism. They have accused him of everything from describing an LSD trip to telling an outright lie. In an attempt to resolve the controversy, investigative research associates sought the expertise of former military intelligence officer Charles R. McQuiston. During World War II, McQuiston and a fellow officer developed a prototype of a revolutionary new truth test called Psychological Stress Evaluation, or PSE. The PSE instrument measures tiny nerve impulses from the brain, which are transmitted to a person's vocal cords. Using a tape recorder at slow speed, a moving needle translates the voice impulses onto a narrow strip of paper, similar to a lie detector or a hospital electrocardiogram. Police departments in several states are using PSE instead of traditional lie detectors, which many times register artificial stress due to anxiety produced by the test itself. Charles McQuiston discusses the result of his PSE evaluation of Travis Walton.
I have run the subject Walton on some 30 charts to ascertain certain basic things. Number one, I think the prime consideration is any possibility of a hoax on the part of Walton in the story that he is telling. I have noticed several indications of what may well be embellishment of facts on the part of the subject, but in no way do they interfere with my impression that he really believes what he is saying. I think that it's a simple case of the story having been retold many times, and it has been polished as it has been told. In other words, I think he's trying to be as accurate as he can, but he is putting in words that would not necessarily have been there the first time that he told the story. He is under varying degrees of stress, ranging from extreme stress almost to the panic point in describing certain traumatic elements of this experience, and I don't think this would be possible if it was any kind of a hoax being perpetrated on his part. Whether, in fact, it happened at all, or to the degree that he says it did, is really irrelevant in terms of this instrumentation, because I can only tell you whether or not he really believes what he's saying, and I believe that he does, that he is sincere.
Dr. Hynek summarizes the Walton controversy.
I've always divided the Travis Walton case, in my own mind, into two parts. The first, which involved six witnesses who were given lie detector tests, five of whom completed it successfully, and the sixth was inconclusive but not negative. That part of the story fits a very definite pattern, the sighting of a brilliantly illuminated object which was hovering not too far from the ground. All of that fits. The second part, the actual abduction of Travis Walton, of course, we have only his word for this, but the story does hang together, and it is unusual in that the time lapse was so long, 5 days, whereas in most of the abduction cases, the time lapse and the time aboard, so to speak, is a matter of minutes or hours. Further, the rigorous analysis given the psychological stress evaluation test by Mr. McQuiston seems to indicate that Walton is indeed telling the truth.